From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The debate over another coronavirus relief bill comes to a head, and the Supreme Court leaves Pennsylvania's ballot extension in place. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal, sitting in today for Paul Jugot. We are joined today by my colleague Kim Strassel. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Kyle.
And Bill McGurn. Hello, Bill.
Hi, Kyle.
One way or another, the end of these long negotiations for a phase five coronavirus relief bill, the end appears to be here. Speaker Nancy Pelosi's latest offer, just to review, was a $2.2 trillion bill. Republicans put up a proposal of nearly $1.9 trillion. And then over the weekend, Nancy Pelosi issued something of an ultimatum, saying there were 48 hours left to come to an agreement that could get passed before the election. Bill, what's the story here?
Well, there's a lot of different factions in here. I think one story is there are a lot of Republicans in the Senate that aren't too thrilled with the package. I think the other story, the political story, is that President Trump got a lot of blowback for saying he was leaving the negotiations rather than leave it to Nancy Pelosi to be blamed for him. Then he came back in, and then he said he would want even more than what the Democrats are proposing. So I think a lot of this is about who's going to be left with the potato, who's going to get blamed if it doesn't go through. And each side wants to make sure the other is getting the blame.
Yeah, and as you say, it's still not clear that a deal around $2 trillion or north of that could get through the Senate,
right,
where it would need 13 Republican votes. So here's what Majority Whip John Thune said Monday night. He said, my guess is the leader, meaning Mitch McConnell, is going to want to see some evidence that whatever is agreed upon has Republican support to try to convince Republicans over here to be for it, when their natural instinct, depending on how big it is and what's in it, is probably going to be against it, unquote. And so Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, on his own part, is planning some more votes on narrower target ideas. Kim, what's in those? Is this similar to what they voted on in past weeks? I mean, I feel like we've had this conversation several times now.
Yeah, so here's the thing. McConnell's not going to bring a bill, or is unlikely to bring a bill, to the floor that's going to divide his membership and make the Republican Party look disunited, and in fact give Democrats a win with Republican help. That's not how you generally do politics in D.C. So what he's been attempting to do is to remind the president that there's a limited amount of support among Republicans for a big blowout bill. And remember, think about these numbers we're talking about here. You know, anything more than $1 trillion is more than the stimulus Obama passed when we were dealing with, the recession and the financial crash. I mean, these are enormous numbers, and that's after having spent $3.5 trillion already this year, or I should say racking up a deficit that large. So he's probably got support for about $500 billion worth of provisions. And in fact, the Senate Republicans will attempt to bring up a bill on Wednesday that is about that number, and it will include some funding for schools, some continued expanded unemployment benefits, and another round of money for the Paycheck Protection Program. And I expect to see Democrats block that. And that gets back to Bill's point that this at the moment is that's why McConnell's bringing it up. He knows that the Democrats won't go for it, but he wouldn't like them, as we get closer to Election Day, to take the blame for not moving forward on this.
And their argument then, Bill, is that Nancy Pelosi is to blame, that if the idea is to get something done, why not pass these provisions on which both sides agree, more or less?
Yeah, I agree with that. Look, I'm very skeptical of the bill, and it's not just dollar amounts. I mean, the Democrats want to include a lot of money to bail out states that are in trouble because of their own fiscal choices. So I think there are a lot of Republican senators who are skeptical about that, and I'm skeptical. So it's not just the top line amount, which is also a concern for some people about the spending. It's what, you know, it's what they would spend it on. I think Mrs. Pelosi entered this not wanting to have anything end up that Donald Trump could take credit for. And she's largely earned that. But there's a downside, too. Some of her more moderate members in her own party, like Connor Lamb in Pennsylvania, want a deal. They want to be able to say, we've worked something out, and they don't have it.
So there are some tensions on both sides within the parties. Meanwhile, I mean, President Trump is sort of scrambling things up as he tends to do. On Tuesday, he said this on TV. He said, I want to do it even bigger than the Democrats. And then he went on to say that Pelosi's at $2.2 trillion, quote, and I would be willing to do more because I think that, number one, I view it differently. We get the money back. The government, it gets the money back ultimately anyway, unquote. And Kim, the president's, I mean, he seems to think that if there's some agreement with Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and Pelosi, and then President Trump comes out and says, this is the deal, we're going to go for it, that Senate Republicans will ultimately fall in line. And I don't know what you think of that, but I'm a little skeptical.
Well, one of two things seems to be happening here. One argument is that this is to put pressure on Senate Republicans, as you say. And look, in the past, Republicans often are wary of crossing the president's, especially at high stakes issues. I think in this case, it's going to be really hard to get them to go along and therefore for McConnell to put it on the floor. Because for every guy out there like a Lindsey Graham who wants a big deal because they're in a tough race and they want to say that they brought home the bacon for the state, there is a fiscal conservative in the Senate, and there are probably more of them who are like, we cannot justify going that high. They're also very unhappy about the fact that the bill is not dealing with the number one priority that they walked into this fall with, which was some sort of liability for protection for businesses and institutions that reopen their door against coronavirus lawsuits. So there could be that. The other potential of what's going on here is that the president has understood what many of us have been saying for a while, which is that Nancy Pelosi has no intention of getting to yes, that she wants to drag this out and make it look as though Republicans are the hurdle and the problem and stick the blame on them. And if you see polls out there, she needs to do that because at the moment, a lot of voters still blame this on Democrats. If that is the way the president's looking at this and he believes Nancy isn't going to get to a yes, then yeah, just go out there and say, I want even more. Because he knows that there's not really much of a potential for a deal. And so he might as well get credit for thinking bigger.
It does seem, though, looking at a little bit of the polling, that that President Trump is winning it so far, if maybe marginally. So there's a YouGov survey last week of about 1,500 voters, and it says that they spread the blame roughly evenly for the breakdown of negotiations here. 43% blaming Pelosi, 40% blaming President Trump. Not surprisingly, Republicans generally say the Democrat is at fault, and Democrats generally say the Republican is at fault. But among independent voters, it's not quite so even, Bill. It's 45% say Pelosi's in the wrong here and only 30% Trump.
Yeah, I think that's the problem with it. And again, the president's gone back and forth in his own messaging on that. In the end, I'm not sure that's going to be dispositive. I think there are bigger issues, you know, COVID and so forth. But, you know, in the last 2 weeks, their goal is to blame the other person for whatever failings the American people see.
Well, I guess, Kim, do you agree with that? I mean, do you think that there's any real negotiating still going on here as we approach this deadline for Nancy Pelosi? Or do you agree with Bill that this is now basically a game of hot potato?
I think it's mostly hot potato. I mean, look, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin is going to roll out there every day, and he's the designated negotiator. But we've been doing this now for, what, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, and not getting anywhere. And, you know, actually, though, at the same time, think you're a bit optimistic that the deadline will be tomorrow, because every time we have one of those deadlines, it just gets pushed off again. At the same time, what's pushing against this is, look, a lot of senators and congressmen want to get back out to their districts and campaign. And I would wager that we're going to see in the Senate this attempt to pass their legislation tomorrow. There's going to be a vote in the Senate committee on Amy Coney Barrett on Thursday. They are currently looking to work through the weekend and debate and talk over the weekend and have that vote on Monday. And at that point, I'd argue there's going to be an enormous push for everybody to get out and spend the last week before the election in their districts.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
Join the Wall Street Journal at the Future of Everything Festival on May 21st to 23rd in New York City, where diverse global newsmakers share unique perspectives on navigating a changing world. Immerse yourself in live performances, explore pioneering technologies, and indulge in the city's inventive culinary scene. As a podcast listener, enjoy 20% off current ticket rates with code PODCAST. Visit wsj.com/FOEF podcast to secure your spot.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. But the background for some of these negotiations, I think it's important to keep in mind, is, now that the government's fiscal year is over, ended September 30, we have some official figures, and the Treasury Department announced last week that the 2020 deficit hit $3.1 trillion. The Journal's news story on this cites an estimate that the federal debt hit 102% of GDP, the first time that figure has been over 100% in 70 years, according to that source. And I mean, I guess my read of this bill is that most Republicans in the House and Senate would probably be for that targeted $500 billion deal or something like it. But they are looking at those debt numbers. And if the question is whether they want to put another $2.2 or $2.4 or $1.9 trillion on that pile, the answer is no.
Right, exactly. I mean, this is the dilemma of politics. Even if you think something doesn't won't work or won't produce the desired result for all the money spent, politicians have an incentive to want to show something. It doesn't matter. They never proved that it actually did what it was touted to do, but they want to go to the public and say something. And usually the measure in Washington is size, right? How many billions, how many trillions? And, you know, that's the sad dynamic of Democratic politics.
And finally, on Monday, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, refused to stay an extension of ballot deadlines in Pennsylvania. Just recall that the state Supreme Court there last month issued an order saying that officials had to count ballots that come in 3 days late. And if the postmark is missing or illegible, that ballot is presumed to have been mailed on time unless there's evidence to the contrary. And Republicans appealed that from the state Supreme Court to the U.S. Supreme Court, which split, now that we have eight justices, split 4-4. With Chief Justice John Roberts joining the liberal side of the bench, meaning that no stay is granted and that the state Supreme Court decision extending the ballot deadline remains in place. Kim, what do you make of that that split non-decision, I guess?
Well, this is not good either for the rule of law or for a cleaner outcome come election day. And it's really disappointing to see Chief Justice Roberts join Justices Stephen Breyer and Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan in this, because, you know, this was a guy who, when he went through his confirmation hearings, said that he was a textualist. He reads the law as it's written. His job is not to make the law, but to call balls and strikes. And it's written right there in the Pennsylvania statute that ballots need to be returned by 8 p.m. on election day. So this should not have been a very hard call. Now, some people will make the arguments and the excuse that he didn't want to interfere and overturn the state Supreme Court and state law versus federal law, etc. But if you're just looking at the textualist reading of this, it's not very tough. So one thing to note, that this was a request for a stay It was not a request for the Supreme Court to get into the merits of this case, which means the Trump campaign has another shot at asking that. And, you know, if this comes back up to the court, potentially maybe even before Election Day, you could have a different court sitting in front of you, namely the addition of Amy Coney Barrett.
Yeah, Bill, just to take that up a little bit, I mean, one distinction that Kim brings up is you could make an argument, maybe Roberts would make the argument, it was a 4-4 split, so we didn't really get an opinion from the court, but maybe he would make the argument that there's a reason for federal courts to be reluctant to wade into issues of state law. This was a state Supreme Court decision based on state law. And that Roberts is less reluctant to pull back federal courts when they make last minute changes to election rules. I mean, do you find that argument convincing? I guess it is notable that the court's four conservatives, other than Roberts, were not convinced by that. I mean, the four of them said that they would have granted the stay.
Right. Look, Kyle, you've written a lot about this subject, so you know. To me, it's very simple. I'm not persuaded by this argument. For two reasons. One is this decision affects a federal election, right? So there is a federal interest in it. And the second is, as Kim points out, the text is so clear. It seems to me the states can make up the rules they want, but they have to abide by their own rules and not have a court agree to change them. Especially in something affecting a presidential election. So I think you would agree, it's a weak argument. You know, superficially, yes, let the states, but that doesn't mean they have carte blanche and they should have to live by their own rules, meaning rules made by the people of the state acting through their elected representatives, not some unelected court.
So, Kim, when you say that this could come back up to the U.S. Supreme Court, though, I mean, it seems to me that if it did, at that point, the stakes could be a lot higher. I mean, Pennsylvania is a swing state. It was a 2016 swing state. It is projected to be potentially a 2020 swing state. And there has been a lot of litigation at the state level on these ballot issues. They have had litigation over what they call naked ballots, which is ballots that are returned without the secrecy envelope that they're supposed to be returned inside. There's state litigation on whether local officials can do any signature verification. And it seems to me what you're suggesting is, if the Electoral College comes down to Pennsylvania and there's a stack of ballots sitting to the side that aren't counted, that this could get litigated again up to the Supreme Court. But then at that point, aren't the stakes and the complaints that will be inevitable about the court's legitimacy, which always comes up, aren't those just even higher then?
Right, which was another reason that this is such a backward decision by John Roberts. I mean, we all know that the Chief Justice spends his nights awake worrying about the quote unquote legitimacy of the Supreme Court. And you know, he may well have thought in joining the liberals in this that he was somehow disproving all of those claims, you know, and all of the talk that we have had recently about Trump's court and are they trying to help the Trump team. You know, this was a common refrain of Democrats during Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation hearings. So he may well have thought, okay, you know, I'm going to prove that, you know, this is not Trump's court, you know, which, by the way, has nothing to do with the merits of this, but he's thinking politically. And the problem with that, as you say, is that if you're really concerned about the legitimacy of the Supreme Court, you wait until it has to make a really tough decision with a brand new justice in the middle of an enormous election dispute in which a presidential election may hang in the balance. You know, there's no good scenario for the court at that point. And, you know, John Roberts should have thought about that harder, because it wouldn't have been nearly as painful to simply say, look, here's what the text of the statute says, and Pennsylvania has to follow the rules. And by the way, it has a legislature, last I looked. And if it really didn't feel as though this was a reasonable scenario in a pandemic situation, it should have held an emergency meeting and passed new legislation that the governor would have signed. But it didn't do that, and this is the law. That would have been much easier to make a rational explanation for in an opinion than to wait and see what's about to come.
And then you at least can fall back on the defense that what we did was we told Pennsylvania to run the election by the book. Everybody has to be aware that the polling for President Trump is not looking great. The last I checked, he was down in Pennsylvania by 7 or 8 points, something like that, Bill. I mean, so maybe part of the calculation here is kick this election litigation and, you know, what are the odds, roll the dice, and what are the odds that it's actually going to be a, you know, Florida year 2000? Let's cross our fingers and hope not. I mean, is that part of the calculation potentially, Bill?
I think it may be part of the calculation, but we have so many variables this year with all the, with COVID and the lack of in-person balloting in many places. I mean, you and I live in New Jersey where there's no in-person voting. We all got ballots in the mail. I think the sheer volume of that, I mean, some states, I believe Kim's home state, have voted by absentee ballot for years, all mail ballots. But to do this, to increase this the way we've done exponentially in 1 year, I just think we're begging for issues, not just in Pennsylvania, but a lot of other states. If you go back to the Democratic primaries, for example, and just look at it in one state, you know, whether it's Iowa or wherever, we had so many problems. And I just think they're going to be multiplied. And my fear is that whichever side loses is going to complain they were robbed. Whether or not they were, there's going to be so many complications and perhaps so many court decisions that it's going to really discredit the elections.
All right, one last question on this, Kim. Does this highlight the question of Amy Coney Barrett being added to the court and having a full complement of 9 justices to decide any election cases, and particularly the push by Democrats during her confirmation hearings to get her to say that she would recuse from any election cases simply because she was appointed by the president who's running for re-election?
And she refused, and rightly so. And we're seeing how important that decision she made was. Because, look, the other aspect of this is that nobody in the country wins when the Supreme Court is issuing tied cases, okay? It's not offering any real clarity. Because there was a 4-4 tie, all it meant was that the lower court decision stood. How would that have looked if there were 9 justices on the court? Especially because at that point, and if you hadn't had that vacancy, would John Roberts have acted in the same way? Maybe he would have ruled a different direction. So having a shorthanded court is just not a good situation. And it's going to be really important that she's there, confirmed and in place, so that we don't have more 4-4 ties on even more complicated issues as we head into the election season. And then we'll see, too. It'll be very interesting if the court is again working with a full complement. And now there are 6 in theory Republican justices. What does that mean for John Roberts? You know, does he feel more comfortable ruling on the law and with his colleagues? Does he break more often? We just don't know. But the basic point of having ACB on that court and within the next week was proven Monday with that Pennsylvania ruling.
And then one last thing, just to provide a better number. So looking it up now, the Real Clear Politics average in Pennsylvania is 3.9 points in favor of Biden. And looks like it's tightening a little bit as we go forward here. So maybe the odds are not as good as the Supreme Court would like to think. So thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.